You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, August 18th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, proprietor of the Forever Wars Substack, Spencer Ackerman, on his new book, Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. Also on the program today, the Taliban claim there will be no reprisals. U.S. military takes over half of the Kabul airport. Meanwhile, congressional Democrats fall over themselves to investigate the Afghan withdrawal. UK announces it will take 20,000 Afghan refugees over the course of 5 years. Meanwhile, Alabama has negative ICU beds free. Negative ICU beds free in Alabama. And the Republican Texas Governor Abbott, three times vaccinated, getting monoclonal treatment for breakthrough COVID, still supporting his ban of mask mandates in Texas schools to protect unvaccinated children. Haiti earthquake toll tops 2,000 people now. TSA in this country extends the airline mask requirement until January of 2022. And Nancy Pelosi plans a test vote on Monday to challenge the corporate Democrats obstructing the infrastructure bill. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is Wednesday.
Hump day.
Hump day, as Emma Vigeland says. Hello, Emma.
I think some other people say it. I don't want to own hump day.
Did you not coin that term?
Is this news to you?
It's the first I've heard of it.
Oh, well, then I did, actually.
Wow.
It sounds...
I get it. It's like you're right at the precipice of the week.
Right, and, because the week is 7 days.
Precipice? No, maybe.
And then the middle day.
Gotcha. Bingo. Well,
actually,
there we go.
Actually, that's not true, because it's about the weekday. The weekday is 5 days.
That's correct.
So
I knew.
The middle day is Wednesday.
There you go. Solved. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us. Very excited to have Spencer Ackerman on the program today. This piece, in and of itself, video is indicative of a dynamic in this country, but it's particularly relevant, I think, to Spencer Ackerman's thesis today, which is that, and we'll get into this more about when we talk about the book, but in many respects, the era following 9/11, in terms of both mechanically, but also in terms of our politics, sort of greased the rails to revive a big part of what propelled Donald Trump to his presidency: racism, anti-immigrant fervor. And here's Charlie Kirk. This guy is sort of, you know, having to transition from being a, you know, very old college student who was chairing TPUSA, and he's seeing the writing on the wall. Maybe some of his funding is is having problems because his billionaire or millionaire benefactor passed away a year or two ago, and so he's doing a show now. And Rush Limbaugh cleared the field a little bit, mm-hmm. In departing the scene, as it were. And here's Charlie Kirk having a, I mean, imagine, I don't know if Charlie Kirk believes that Joe Biden intentionally forced this scene that's taking place at the at Kabul. I don't know if he's ignoring the 20 years of history of Afghanistan. I don't know if he thinks it's in the level of dementedness, I should say, exhibited by Charlie Kirk here is pretty impressive. And it is all in service of a racist, anti-immigrant, and, you know, probably a little misogyny thrown in there as well.
Sure.
Here is Charlie Kirk responding to the fall of Afghanistan with, of course, the normal reaction.
Biden's Department of Defense will accept 30,000 Afghan refugees into military installations following the collapse of Kabul. Boom. Political transformation. Let the country crumble. Do you know there's 5 million displaced people in Afghanistan now? This was all intentional. Joe Biden let it fall apart to now say, oh, I'm so sorry. I guarantee you Joe Biden's speech this afternoon will talk about refugee assistance and relocation support. Now, Joe Biden's going to be scrambling to make good on it, and the liberal media will love it. They'll say, oh, yes, okay, now I get it. Joe Biden is now fixing his own problem. Joe Biden is stepping up, and he's allowing a flow of people from the Middle East into America. Thank you, Joe Biden. You're such a hero. You're so benevolent. You're so respectful. You're so compassionate. Do you see what's going on here? What's going on here is Joe Biden wants a couple hundred thousand more Ilhan Omars to come into America to change the body politic permanently.
Huh.
We're playing checkers, and they're playing chess.
Oh, were it so.
I mean...
Well, let's just do a little bit of math. First off, let's just take it at face value for a moment.
Okay.
30,000 refugees, and I would argue this is way too low, but again, we're just going to take this to face value, is not going to transform the country.
Well, it's just the beginning.
I mean, if you were maybe to bring 30,000 refugees to one small town, you would see a political transformation in that town.
Yeah, but he's not talking about Afghanistan, right? He's talking about Somalia.
Well, he's talking. No, well, now you're getting ahead of it. Now, he is arguing that Joe Biden specifically allowed the Taliban to take over the country to create a refugee crisis because Joe Biden thinks it's in his political, it is helpful for him politically to bring in 30,000 or even 100,000 or even hundreds of thousands of Afghan refugees. Now, there is no doubt that we could absorb a couple hundred thousand Afghan refugees with a blink of an eye. With a blink of an eye, we could do that. Politically, frankly, I'm not quite convinced that this would help any party one over the other. Certainly, Afghans have grievances with both parties. And culturally, I imagine Afghans are far more sympathetic to the conservative cultural values, maybe, of some of the Republicans, particularly the more religious. I mean, Mike Pence, the vice president, he won't even have dinner with women, who he works with because mm-hmm. he's married.
Too tempting.
Similar dynamic. But it's also just insane. And it's also incredibly heartless. And the idea that we could have hundreds of thousands of refugees who come into this country and become Congress people, that would be fantastic. First off, we would need to expand Congress, which I'm also in favor of. I don't know if I would do it into the hundreds of thousands, but that would be great.
Well, he's indicating that they'll be able to vote, which we don't know. But of course, then they'll have kids and they'll be brown and they'll be in your communities. And you don't really want that, right? You mentioned it's racist. you mentioned it's anti-immigrant. I mean, the biggest through line is, like, part of the racism is the Islamophobia. They want to continue.
It's the Islamophobia, and though it's also the same sort of white nationalism that we hear Tucker Carlson talk about, right? Immigrants equals political transformation.
Yes.
This is no, and this goes back to Pat Buchanan. It goes back to the John Birchers. It goes back to anti-Chinese immigration laws. I mean, this is a tried true history, principle of the United States.
But they connect it to a terrorist attack in this country, which increases the ferocity of it. And we were surveilling, at least in terms of how we treated a group in this country in modern America. There's nothing like what we've seen of how we've treated Muslim people in this country.
And
surveilled them.
And that is a great segue into Spencer Ackerman's book. Yeah. Which we will get to just after this break. We'll be right back after this. Got a couple of sponsors on the program today. Emma's favorite.
Oh, Jesus. It's my fault for saying hump day.
Yep.
Rump day.
Hey, exactly. It's rump day, folks. Summer's here. Living ain't easy if you got swamp ass. Everybody knows that. Don't have to.
Many people are saying that living ain't easy.
How are you going to stay on top of your sweaty bottom? Well, I'll tell you, it's a refreshing spray from a Hello Tushy bidet. Yes, you can keep yourself fresh and clean all summer long with the brand new Hello Tushy 3.0 modern bidet attachment. But don't kid yourself. We're going into fall. Works just as well. It is stylish. It is eco-friendly. It is super easy to install and dramatically less expensive than you think it is. And in addition, it ongoingly, on an ongoing basis, saves you money. Hello Tushy 3.0 doesn't just clean your butt with a precise stream of fresh water. It cleans itself with a smart spray automatic nozzle. It attaches to your existing toilet. You don't need any electricity at all. You don't need any extra plumbing. Cuts your toilet paper use by 80%. Pays for itself in a few months. I can't believe how much toilet paper is.
Yeah.
You could be like, I don't know, like,
it's ridiculous.
It's like, ridiculous.
The Charmin. I thought about this the other day. It's like, oh, I want to get a 6-pack of Charmin, and it's that much money.
I can't remember if it's like $20 or something like that. It's
something
crazy.
Like that. Yeah.
You get like the the 4-time roll because you can't get the smaller ones anymore. Anyways, the point is, Hello Tushy is the way to go. If you've ever been bidet curious like I was, this is a great way to fundamentally change something that we all do. 60, I'm not going to tell you what it is.
Okay.
60-day risk-free guarantee, 12-month warranty. If you've already got a Hello Tushy, treat yourself to the new 3.0 model. You will join millions of happy Hello Tushy customers. Defeat swamp ass. Go to hellotushy.com/majority. Get 10% off plus free shipping. This is a special offer for our listeners at hellotushy.com/majority for 10% off. hellotushy.com/majority. Also, here is a common scenario. You need to see a doctor. You search, you find one that looks good. You wait on hold to book an appointment. You rearrange your schedule. Then you finally go in, find out this doctor doesn't even take your insurance. But there's a solution. You download the free ZocDoc app. It's the easiest way to find a great doctor and instantly book an appointment. And you can search local doctors to find out who takes your insurance. You read verified patient reviews, and you can book an appointment, and you can do so in person or video chat. You don't have to wait on hold with a receptionist. Whether you need a primary care physician, dentist, dermatologist, psychiatrist, eye doctor, or other specialist, ZocDoc has you covered. You guys have used this quite a bit, right?
It's just so much easier to be able to look at the calendar and book your appointment, and you don't need to waste time on the phone, and sometimes you can't reach or you don't have the right number. Doctors have multiple offices. This makes it a lot more simple.
Look, you go to ZocDoc.com/majority. You download the ZocDoc app to sign up, and it's free. Every month, millions of people use ZocDoc, including half of this office. ZocDoc makes healthcare easy, and now is the time to prioritize your health. Go to ZocDoc.com/majority. Download the ZocDoc app to sign up for free and book a top-rated doctor. Many are available as soon as today. That's ZocDoc, ZocDoc.com/majority, ZocDoc.com/majority. All right. Very excited to welcome back to the program Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, the proprietor of the Forever Wars newsletter on Substack, and author of his first book, Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. Spencer Ackerman, welcome back to the show. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Hi, Sam. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Spencer.
So, you know, Spencer, we played a clip of Charlie Kirk at the top of the show, talking about how Joe Biden had purposely wanted the Taliban to overrun Kabul to create this sympathy for these internal and external or would-be external refugees so that he could bring in thousands of immigrants and fundamentally have a political change in this country, change the nature of our country. And it occurred to me that this is very much the thesis of your book, this combination of the war on terror that has been perpetrated for 20 years. And it's sort of like melding into this message of anti-immigrant and racism that Charlie Kirk and Donald Trump, have sort of risen upon.
That's right. This has been there from the start of the war on terror. These are the politics of the war on terror. The way I wrote about this this week for my Substack, Forever Wars, is that this was the return of white replacement theory version 1.0. What do I mean by that? I mean by what we saw by degree. Used against American Muslims after 9/11, and then very aggressively yielding way to Trump, is a constrained space for American Muslims to enjoy the benefits of citizenship. This was what was behind something that I think a lot of observers, certainly liberal observers, but some on the left as well, kind of dismissed. When state houses around the country under Republican governance passed laws to ban Sharia law, that we didn't quite understand what was really at play here. If you were not Muslim, you had the luxury of being able not to understand what was happening here. This is the same impulse that transformed a cultural center comparable to the 92nd Street Y on the Upper East Side of New York from a symbol of cosmopolitanism and a contribution to the intellectual life of New York City into the Ground Zero Mosque in 2010. When that happened, there were predictable consequences. A person who was working as a cab driver in New York City during the Ground Zero Mosque outrages was stabbed when a mosque outside Murfreesboro, Tennessee, expanded in order to cover its, you know, ever increasing congregations of worshipers who, I might add, many of whom were refugees from the Iraq War. That was scandalized, that was blocked, and that was deeply demonized by the local power structure over there, to the point where signs for the mosque would be shot at. This is where this all comes from. This is a narrative of replacement. That was what was at work with saying, as they put it themselves, Newt Gingrich talked about this in a speech at the American Enterprise Institute, which is to say that before this was not considered respectable, this was respectable. This was done by respectable people, people with power and influence. Newt Gingrich was, of course, the Speaker of the House. He talked about the point of the advancing Sharia law in the United States was to replace the Constitution, replace the American way of life. This was how it got to the point where the white supremacists with the tiki torches could march through Charlottesville saying that they would not be replaced by Jews. This is what's happening here. This is their response to the human disaster that is not just the withdrawal from Afghanistan, but the Afghanistan war itself, that the actual enemies turn out to be not what the sort of mainstream understandings, the explicit text, for lack of a better term, of the war on terror say they are, not the Taliban. The Taliban aren't the real enemy here at all. The enemies are the people escaping the Taliban, the people who are trying to live in what the United States' disastrous wars promise but never deliver, freedom and safety. And this is exactly what we saw after the rise of the so-called Islamic State, where governments across Europe and several states in the United States, I think ultimately 30 of them, insist the response is to build a respectable, in some cases in Europe in particular, liberal version of Donald Trump's border wall. And we have to recognize this as the fruits of the war on terror, and the war on terror giving every motive, opportunity, and validation to these sorts of re-empowered nativist currents.
For folks who are too young to remember this, the passage of those state houses, passing anti-Sharia law resolutions or is very similar to the sort of the critical race theory can't be taught in kindergartens, movement of today. And so let's go back to pre 9/11. In fact, let's go. You start the book in Oklahoma, and one of the things that occurred to me was in bringing me back to that time was there was this period of time where when the wall fell and the Soviet Union essentially dissipated, that there was like the right in this country was sort of, and maybe the whole country on some level was sort of searching around for, the enemy. And it was sort of a very confusing time, sort of in that that vacuum, we get Oklahoma bombing and Timothy McVeigh. Why did you start there?
I started there for two reasons, one of which is cheeky and the other which I hope is seen as serious. The cheeky reason is that I start the book with a journalistic cliche. I take you to a terror training camp where we meet all kinds of basically crazy people, crazy violent people, crazy violent misogynists who are like dedicated to both like kind of training themselves and seeking out an exceptionally backward and violent new status quo, except I wanted these to be white people. I didn't want to do the thing that you've read throughout a whole lot of, very poor war on terror journalism, some of which it embarrasses me to say I have written, where, only those non-white people and those Muslim people at such camps are treated this way. And then the more profound thing is that, or I hope it's profound, is that in order to see the whole war on terror, in order to see something we typically discuss in terms of its component parts, Afghanistan, Iraq, Guantanamo, torture, surveillance, down the line, we need to see who the exceptions to the war on terror are. We need to see that after the impact of what was at the time the most devastating terrorist attack in American history, the response by the political system, by the Democratic and the Republican parties, is not to construct the apparatus of repression and globally licensed violence that happens after 9/11. It's instead to first blame Muslims for committing this activity. Secondly, to derive as a response the narrowest possible definition of a response only geared around McVeigh and his immediate associates. And it listens during this period to what I think are valuable and valid, enduringly valid and universally valid objections that say to do otherwise, to say that people with superficial associations to people who commit acts of violence ought not to come under an atmosphere of suspicion that they can probably never escape, and that redressing problems you have politically with such people who, again, who don't commit the act of violence with the machinery of state repression, the extremely punitive, coercive, and intimidating powers of law enforcement and of prosecutors, that wouldn't be right. That wouldn't be a real substitute to confronting those propositions politically. America sympathizes with that when terrorism is white. When terrorism is not white, it is a much different story.
All right. So the idea is that following and there's two sort of like the main thrusts to the so-called war on terror. One is the or the post 9/11 era. Let's say it is the mechanical sort of material response to that that involves the literal surveillance and then the wars and the drones and more, and then there's the political. And so let's try and sort of, we have younger viewers who don't remember that era following 9/11, where, James Comey, was a key player in this, Robert Ashcroft era, where they would spy on Muslims because they were Muslim, to a degree that I don't think people sort of really remember at this point. Talk about the databases, talk about the infiltration of the student youth groups. I just remember being in New York and hearing like there was five Muslims who were driving down from, upstate New York and got pulled over, that type of stuff. Fort Dix Five. I mean, there was many, many stories like this.
So I'm from Brooklyn, New York. I'm a native of a neighborhood called Flatbush. And right nearby me is a very small enclave known as Little Pakistan, a working class immigrant neighborhood. And I recently went back and looked at some of the reports that people from that neighborhood filed after 9/11. And these are reports from young teenagers, girls and boys who were 13, 14, 15, 16 years old, talking about how not just from fellow students, but from teachers and from police, they were called Osama. They were treated as terrorists. They were told to go back to their country. These are my neighbors. This is New York. And that was the tenor of the response, that a generation of Muslim children, and not even just Muslims, it's often forgotten, but once an apparatus of suspicion arose that treated immigration not as a tool to make more Americans, but as the vector of a national security threat, all immigrants who are stuck dealing with the immigration authorities in the United States get treated like that. There's an excellent book by Trum Nguyen called We Are All Suspects Now that traces this in non-Muslim immigrant communities. This was the tenor of the war on terror. You mentioned databases. The Department of Homeland Security created a database called NSEERS, which was in all functions by any other name, a Muslim registry. It was a registry of people from Muslim backgrounds, Muslim majority countries, and countries with heavy Muslim populations that had to register in this database. And many, many, many of them were deported as the result of this. This was a circumstance in which John Ashcroft, at the time George W. Bush's attorney general, guided by an immigration advisor we would come to know very well more recently in the Trump era, named Chris Kobach, who invited Muslims in this country to prove their loyalty by, particularly if they were non-citizens looking for a path to citizenship, by informing on their communities. Ashcroft, when called on this, responded to it with absolute umbrage. This was so bad and repressive, and that even like chiefs of certain police departments like were not comfortable performing it, which should really tell you quite a lot. Ashcroft goes to testify before the Senate in December of 2001, and says, in words I'll just never forget, that the people who were complaining about this, the people who were saying this was wrong, were the people who the United States had to worry about. They were people who were dividing America by criticizing the lawless actions and the repressive racist actions of their government. And he goes, those who continue to scare Americans with, and these were his words, phantoms of lost liberty, were those people whose actions, he says, only aid terrorism. That was the political culture of the 9/11 era. That culture may have receded somewhat. I would argue, in fact, that all it has done is been normalized. And we live today currently in that in those politics. Our politics, our economic system, our society is very profoundly and very materially shaped by this. It occurs within our politics, within guidelines, particularly when it comes to discussions of security, set by the war on terror.
And we should say, like, you know, at this point, it becomes, I think, clear for folks how the war on terror is a way of saying we're going to normalize and legitimize a racism or anti-Muslim perspective, which then begins to sort of revive both the anti-immigrant sentiment and as we move through the Bush years, we normalize torture to a large extent, or at least, you know.
No, you're right. You're right.
Debatable.
Go off, King.
Right. And well, I mean, we all remember this. And it just occurred to me today, like, you know, when we're hearing the Democrats crawl over each other to talk about the failure of the withdrawal, like, I'm like, well, how about you go back to the Senate torture report? Let's see if we can get that out too, now that we control the Senate. With that said, we go through the Bush years, and this mutates, or really doesn't have to mutate very far, into, you know, via Barack Obama, into sort of like it sort of becomes the bridge, or Barack Obama and this sort of anti-Muslim fervor and anti-immigrant fervor becomes the bridge into where we are now, both from a material and from a political perspective. Let's talk a little bit about the material. I mean, there's been, you know, and certainly back in the day, I think, like, you know, Charlie Savage covered a lot of this dynamic where Barack Obama comes in, gets this lawless regime of the Bush administration, both from a sort of a drone perspective, from a torture perspective, and he basically codifies it and makes it legal as opposed to getting rid of it. Talk about that dynamic.
Are you guys Lord of the Rings people?
Well, I think I am more than Sam.
It's been a while for me. I'm going to get back into it with my kids soon. But
so when the alliance of elves and men succeeds in miraculously defeating Sauron, their final task is to throw the One Ring into the fires of Mount Doom. And when this happens, Isildur takes the ring and goes out onto kind of like this rocky platform, and the fires below await. And this is the moment of true victory. And Elrond, king of the elves, is screaming at him, throw it into the fire, throw it into the fire. And then Isildur looks at the ring and thinks, this ring is nothing but a tool. What if it had wise leadership?
Mm-hmm.
What amazing things would I be able to accomplish through it? And he decides, instead of destroying the ring, he is wise enough and strong enough to wield the ring. And so the ring survives and ultimately corrupts those who wield it and will return Sauron to life and to power. And that's the story I tell in the book of Barack Obama and the War on Terror. The way I start the chapter on Obama is through a perspective I think we in the United States do not often hear, we in journalism do not often pursue. And that's with a young man named Fahim Qureshi. Fahim Qureshi was 13 years old, living in tribal Pakistan in a village called Zaraki, where he was one Friday attending a big reception for a cousin who had returned from a business trip to the United Arab Emirates. And all of a sudden, he remembered hearing a sound like a plane taking off. And what had happened was Fahim Qureshi, after emerging from a coma 40 days later, with burns over much of his body, was a survivor of Barack Obama's first drone strike. He would be the first of probably thousands of people who had been caught in the fires of the drone strikes, a series of strikes that Obama saw not as a continuity of the war on terror, but an alternative to it, a more humane way of conducting necessary counterterrorism operations, not the excesses of the Bush administration with its agonizing invasions and occupations of other people's countries. But this was the humane and restrained, and ultimately, I call it in the book, sustainable way to conduct the war on terror. And I asked, when I had interviewed Fahim, I heard his story of what his life was like after the 2009 strike. And he talked about how, you know, his primary breadwinners in his family, many of the adult men in his family, were killed in this strike. And so now he had to be one of his family's primary supporters. And he had to just, you know, give up on his dreams. He had wanted to be a chemist, and take whatever jobs he could make his forever wounded body perform. And he did this while being rebuffed by both Pakistani and American authorities for even the recognition of what was done to him. To this day, he has received only like a kind of like lump sum payment. He received blood money, but also hush money as a way of saying, we're not going to acknowledge what we did to you, but, you know, here's some money to deal with it. And I asked him, what do you think of Barack Obama? And Fahim said, Barack Obama, if there is a list of tyrants anywhere in the world, Barack Obama's name is on that list. And I don't really think you can argue with that man's experience.
Yeah, and we should say, I mean, the part of that sustainability, and I should also just say, you know, in service of the book, that you speak to people who were men who were tortured as teenagers at Guantanamo. And folks who were wrapped up in the Patriot Act, you know, for donating money to a charity. I mean, on and on throughout your book, you're addressing sort of both ends of this war on terror. That element of Obama, both that he changed the mechanism and brought it under a legal regime, I think, is also what made that sort of. Well, I mean, that's the thing, is that, you know, if you take, and I don't, it's always sort of like, you know, you got to be tentative when you go down this road, but, you know, you step back, the most horrific things that have happened in world history have been legal. They have been put under a regime of legality, and that gives them the durability and the sustainability to last. And that is one of the things I think that Obama did that is, was the most sort of, not necessarily horrific, but the most problematic in terms of maintaining the sustainability of this, is creating these legal regimes that allow it to be supposedly within the law, but also still just incredibly horrific. And so that is the mechanical thing that happens. And we see the capitulation and the left, or the broadly the, you know, the Democrats sort of be okay with this, and voters also accepting into this notion that, you know, Barack Obama, I mean, I just remember, I can't remember which spokesperson it was for Obama, but when he was questioned about the killing not only of Anwar al-Awlaki, who was the supposed preacher who was, American, who was preaching jihad against America, but his 16-year-old son. And then also subsequent to that, ultimately, the daughter as well. But the 16-year-old son was killed. And the response by an Obama official was, well, his dad was a bad guy.
Yeah.
And they were not killed simultaneously. I mean, to be clear, this was not a collateral damage situation. They took out this guy, too. And there was no, it basically, I don't know.
It was normalized. Here's the thing. This is why it's important to, on the one hand, recognize that, like, atrocities of regimes, state terror, occurs within the patina of legality. It's what a society, or at least the overclass of that society, normalizes, right? That's the difference. These acts didn't need to be legal. These acts just needed to be lawyered. This is what Giorgio Agamben, the Italian philosopher, refers to as the state of exception, that these are extraordinary acts that license state violence and give it a patina of legitimacy so that it doesn't tell itself that those regimes, those legal regimes, have in fact been transformed, have been like functionally abrogated and ripped up. That's what we live in today. That is what Donald Trump does with these things. That is how we get to a point where there was drone surveillance over 15 cities last summer, that joint terrorism task forces take actions against supposed anti-fascist protesters, and that Black Lives Matter is being told to be dealt with as if they were terrorists, from the ultimate symbol, an institution of the war on terror, the Department of Homeland Security. And under Barack Obama, what happens is that Obama decides that these operations, in order for them to continue within what he considers appropriate boundaries, have to be wrapped within a belt of bureaucratic process, where intelligence officials, military officials, and the lawyers, both within the White House, the Justice Department, and all these different agencies, meter out and throttle who can be executed. And stripped of euphemism, that's what it is. You mentioned Charlie's excellent book, Power Wars. I commend everyone. You should really read Power Wars. What Power Wars traces is how a divide existed very early in the Obama administration between the attorneys who take power within the Obama administration, who had been vociferously against George W. Bush and his version of the war on terror, but were now, in fact, split from the human rights critics of the Bush administration and the people that wanted not restraint in the war on terror, but the abolition of the war on terror, because, as I believe it's an Obama administration attorney, Mary DeRosa, who Charlie quotes in the book, saying, like, the thing is that what we're really about is the rule of law. We are not really about the problems that you have to the operations of counterterrorism that's going on. But it was never the rule of law. It was the rule of lawyers.
Right. Well, we saw how fungible that could be under the Bush administration. And then under the Obama administration, I just wonder, Spencer, if you have fears that the Biden administration, despite like holding shockingly firm on this Afghanistan withdrawal, there's not really structural changes being made in the way of limiting the people who might want to fall back on legal principles in pushing forward the war on terror?
These are in the main the same people from the Obama administration. These are the people who are now even more experienced in this machinery, and they are the decision makers now, or they are the decision makers once again, perhaps, at the next, rung up on the ladder. And let's look at that Afghanistan withdrawal, because when we look at it, what becomes conspicuous is what isn't included in it. On Monday, when the president announced that he was staying with the withdrawal from Afghanistan, a negotiated withdrawal, the decision that I believe was the only valorous act of Donald Trump's presidency, to negotiate a withdrawal from Afghanistan because there was no other choice, Biden says that he reserves the right, as you had heard generals and the defense secretary Lloyd Austin say before, to bomb Afghanistan as the United States sees fit, to surveil Afghanistan as the United States sees fit, and to continue facing what Biden calls the threats of today, which is to say that we can only justify withdrawing from one war on terror battlefield in order to strengthen our position on all of the others. That's not the abolition of the war on terror. That is the maintenance of the war on terror. That is the war on terror being made more conspicuous, being made more normalized, and being more entrenched. And this is a powder keg that we have seen throughout essentially the entirety of 21st century America, and it will explode once again if it is allowed to recoalesce. The administration is accepting the congressional efforts at repealing the 2002 AUMF against Iraq. That's a good thing. That's the result of really valiant, persistent organizing amongst activists in and outside Congress and their legislative allies, and they deserve a lot of credit. What we're not seeing yet, and because this has been such an effort, is the administration accepting that the 2001 AUMF, the wellspring legally of a global unbounded by time war, is on the chopping block and ought to be repealed. We are not seeing the repeal of the Patriot Act. We are not seeing the abolition of the Department of Homeland Security. We are not seeing the final end of Guantanamo Bay and the structures necessary to prevent indefinite detention from ever happening again. All of these things remain. All of these things have been normalized. All of the lies about them, the things that, you know, you heard particularly liberals during the Trump administration talk about as if they were, you know, sudden innovations. Oh, my God. The government constantly lies about its operations. The same people who were so shocked and horrified by that were taking their cues politically from the architects and the stewards of the war on terror and treating them as if they were national heroes. It was the recrudescence of the war on terror. We are not seeing the end of this thing. We are only seeing its normalization, its continuation. We should be very clear-eyed about that.
And the you know, I mean, there's a couple of thoughts I have to this. One is that, you know, it may not come about during Biden's term, right? But he is sort of, I guess, tilling the ground, as it were, in places like, I don't know, Somalia or Yemen, where, you know, Tom Cotton, President Tom Cotton or Marjorie Taylor Greene comes in and has the ability to sort of like expand this thing once again. It's still feeding it. And what's also amazing to me about what the Trump years were like in terms of that is that on one hand, you know, John Brennan, a guy who had real trouble in 2008 getting into the Obama administration because of his relationship to the torture regime.
Not true. He had a real problem becoming head of the CIA. He had no problem entering the Obama White House.
Right. Fair enough. And ultimately, that is by the Trump years, more than forgotten. It certainly was forgotten by the second term of the Obama years. But at the same time, there was very few people, I think, were even aware that 2019 in Afghanistan was the most deadly year for civilians. Well, prior to 2018. And then prior to that, it was 2002. And so there was a sort of like, you know, split in terms of I mean, this is just it feeds into that thesis of the normalization and where we are. And I guess the paradox with Obama for having normalized that was on the domestic political side, that war of terror that he's feeding in his administration ends up being the toehold for Donald Trump to rise in the Republican Party, which is birtherism and everything that. On one hand, the war on terror has created the sort of the fertile ground for a resurgence of anti-immigrant and anti-black racism.
Yes, the war on terror doesn't invent things. The war on terror is a door to all of these nativist violent tendencies throughout American history. The United States uses these tools quite a lot. It used waterboarding as a tool of native genocide against Native Americans. It used it against Filipino citizens, Filipino civilians during the Spanish-American War. Torture techniques like stress positions come from chattel slavery. Family separation, you know, child separation, that's native genocide as well. The United States is very well steeped in these tools. It reaches for them because they are so familiar. We should not see them as deviations. And when the war on terror entrenches itself, that will also be the culture of the war on terror. This righteous, justified violence committed by an aggrieved and innocent America that has the right to set the terms for the rest of the world. The war on terror is the result, from an ideological perspective, which is also downstream of material interests that propel the war on terror, of the concept of American exceptionalism, which at its heart means that America sets the terms for the world, and those terms do not necessarily bind America. America acts, America is not acted upon. That is the war on terror. That manifests itself throughout the war on terror, not only by conservatives, but by liberals. This is a major theme in my book. We started out in chapter 3, which is called Liberal Complicity in the War on Terror, and develop it all through to the present day. As long as this is allowed to persist, this will have the same results. If Biden doesn't break these tools, the next president will reach for them and use them, because that's how tools work.
So how does this end? I mean, you know, like if seeing the failure in Afghanistan, right? I mean, it was an abject failure by anybody's terms, you know, short of maybe Lockheed Martin's, this was a failure. You know, we didn't rebuild Afghanistan. We didn't, even if the most sort of vengeful, of people, would have to say like the past 18, 19 years of this have been an abject failure.
Yeah. We didn't rebuild Afghanistan. We rebuilt Crystal City. We rebuilt McLean. Right. We took $6 trillion of public money and redistributed it to the defense industry.
And so how does this end? Is it bit by bit where people say like, okay, now we go for that AUMF, the 2001, now we go and, you know, have a commission to, reinvigorate FISA in some fashion? Is it, we, break up a Department of Homeland Security? I mean, when you contemplate how it might end, and maybe that's a subsidiary question to like, does this end? What does it look like?
Nothing ends unless people organize and force their political leaders to make it end. There are many smart people with many programmatic solutions for how this happens. At the end of the month, I'll be on a panel with many of them. These are people who have fought the war on terror. That is to say, they didn't wage the war on terror. They fought against the war on terror from the start, using the techniques of the rule of law. They have and will have many important programmatic solutions. All I can really tell you as a reporter is that unless the political structure and the security structure feels the pressure of the public in an area that, you know, the United States is not a particularly democratic country. One of the areas in which it is least democratic is foreign policy and national security. Unless elected political figures are made to feel the outrage of the public and made to feel like their careers end, unless they embrace the fulsome destruction in an expansive definition of the war on terror, the repeal without replacement of these authorities, whether it's the 2001 AUMF, whether it's warrantless surveillance, whether it's the Patriot Act, whether it's the Department of Homeland Security, whether it's ICE, whether it's, on and on, then it will continue. But what we see from the dedicated activist work of those who have brought the 2002 AUMF to the point of repeal is that it's possible. We are betraying not only whatever future generations we have left, and I'm someone with two children, by subscribing to a fatalism about this, but we will be breaking solidarity with all of the people, not just at home, but around the world, who will be killed by the war on terror. We can't simply say this is permanent, this is forever. It doesn't have to be forever, but we have to make it not be forever.
Where do you, what do we need inciting events? I mean, are there communities, because it is sort of, you know, genuinely trans ideological on some level, or maybe it is trans, you know, an absence of ideology that allows it to sustain. You know, it was the license that Obama had was very dispiriting. And you would think that there would be more of a lesson of like, you don't know who could come after Barack Obama. It could be Donald Trump. I mean, for all people. And as outrageous as that was, I mean, where what becomes the inciting event for that? Or is it just simply we've got to you grind it out.
You just saw people run after a C-17, try and grab a hold of it and fall to their deaths. Could there, what other event? I don't know how to answer your question besides that.
Yeah. I mean, that is, that is what concerns me, but I do appreciate the idea, you know, having two kids myself, we owe it to them and to, the future victims of the war on terror to fight against it. Spencer Ackerman, the book is for Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. The Substack is Forever Wars, which I encourage everybody to go sign up for. We will put links to both at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Emma.
Thanks, Spencer.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break and we'll come back, wrap things up. Well, can't encourage people enough to check out that book. I think the theme is really fascinating. The way that you know, the concept of foreign wars impacting us domestically is not terribly new. It was MLK had said, you know, every bomb that drops in Vietnam blows up here. I'm paraphrasing. But the idea that the war on terror basically greased the skids, if you will, for a reemergence of some very old and persistent themes in this country on a political level, but on a mechanical level, have normalized things that are just going to keep sort of this machine going. It's disturbing, and people should check it out. A house cleaning note for folks on Peacock, and for the Majority Report who watch it in other places.
Today's his last day.
Today is my last day.
Bye, Sam.
You guys have fun. So long.
Bye.
Well, you know me. I'll probably be back with my tail between my legs. I have a feeling it'll probably be in about a week.
Yeah.
But
about a week, right? Maybe 9 days from now or so, you'll come to your senses and you won't have.
Yeah, I think I could last 9 days without doing that. And then I'll be Jones and I'll be just doing it. Probably by day seven, I'll be talking into my pens, and then, you know, just
and people should know that this you are leaving, you know, for whatever period of time on really bad terms.
Yes. But so, with that said, for our Peacock viewers, probably see you again. Maybe. And for everybody else, you know, we're just going to have to wait to create a little drama and suspense. In the meantime, we're going to head into the fun half of the program. I can't wait to watch Lord of the Rings with Saul and tell him.
I feel like I just saw it.
Yeah, well, I can't wait to tell him, like.
I mean, like, I thought he didn't really do a spoiler alert there, because I thought he was, you know, the history repeats itself with Frodo nearly at the end.
I'm going to watch Lord of the Rings of Saul, and then I'm going to read to him Spencer Ackerman's book.
Mm.
It's nighttime reading after we wrap up the Harry Potter series.
Where are you at in the Harry Potter series?
Book six, I think.
Yeah, you've been saying that for a while now.
No. No, we've been racing through book six.
Right. Well, someone named Matt may have spoiled something for you.
Yeah, you spoiled a bunch of stuff for me. Yeah, we'll read the Harry Potter series and then move on to Chalmers Johnson with blowback, and then go into Spencer Ackerman's book. And then we'll get to Charlie Savage's book.
Yeah. You're just accelerating things, huh?
Yep. Kevin McCarthy's bruised knees. Looking forward to the majority report without Sam Cedar. Distance will make all of our hot hearts grow fonder.
Well, no, you're not allowed to say his name anymore after today.
Without that guy. Folks, you can become a member of the newly minted majority report without that
guy. I'm changing
that
title, too.
By going to jointhemajorityreport.com, that link will still be working.
For the next few hours.
The A-Majority Report.
Yeah.
The A-Majority Report.
A-Majority Report. It's actually pretty seamless.
It's jointhemajorityreport.com, though. For that, we'll fix that link. You can become a member today. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And we continue to get some really nice emails congratulating us on the AM Quickie newsletter version. And you sign up for that by going to majority.fm, scrolling all the way down, signing up for the AM Quickie newsletter. It's really, I think it just says newsletter down at the bottom of the page, but check it out. Every morning, some top stories, a little bit of context, quick read, and you will enjoy it. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Yeah, tonight, this very evening at 8 Eastern time at the Left Reckoning YouTube channel, we'll be having Harvey Kay, the great historian, on to talk about Biden after 200 days. And I'll also be doing a deep dive into Mark Levin. Do you know how to pronounce?
Levin. Get out of here!
Yeah, exactly.
I've listened to a lot of Levin.
Man, that is a tough thing to do, actually.
You're a schmuck! Get off the phone!
He gets very excited. And, like, we're going to try to deprogram some uncles that may have just listened to Mark Levin energy. We want to try to save people from that, because that's a horrible condition. And I also read his American Marxism. I read it and pay for his American Marxism, and I'll do a short review tonight. So that's
you didn't pay for?
No, I didn't. I found it somewhere off of the back of a bus. Or a truck.
Back of a bus? Fell off the back of a bus?
I forgot the phrase, but it fell off the back of a truck, and so I read that. It's bad. But I'm trying to get to the bottom of this thing called the Franklin School, and it's really tough to find out. So see if David Griscom and I can do that at 8 Eastern, Left Reckoning YouTube. Check that out tonight.
Because you guys are on Wednesdays now.
Watch out for that Franklin School.
The nefarious Franklin School out of Berlin.
Really impressive. Folks, see you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. you're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
The win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
Do.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.